Welcome to Second Chances, the Persuasion Podcast. My name is Tom.
And I'm Grace.
We're going through Jane Austen's Persuasion, chapter by chapter. Today we're doing Volume 2, Chapter 11, Part 1. It's a long chapter. But first, Grace, will you give us a brief recap of everything that happened in Volume 2, Chapter 10?
So we learned that Mr. Elliot will actually be leaving the party at Camden Place for a bit, but then he will be back. He's leaving Bath for a few days, but he will be coming back. In a few days. Then we hear a surprise knock at the door, and Mary and Charles have arrived at Bath. Mary tells Anne that a bunch of people from Uppercross are here, including Mrs. Musgrove, Henrietta, Captain Harville, and Captain Wentworth. And so Anne later on goes to visit them at the White Hart, which is an inn at Bath. Elizabeth, out of propriety, feels that she needs to host a party for all of the newcomers, but she doesn't quite know how to host a party without revealing their financial situation, so she decides that instead of hosting a dinner party that will reveal how broke they are, basically, she decides to host a card party and invites everyone, including Captain Wentworth, which is a big deal now because that means that he has basically reached the, like, acceptable status, the same status as the Elliots. and then, also surprisingly, Mary sees Mr. Elliot with Mrs. Clay at the pump room in Bath, even though he said he was going to be away for a few days. And then later on, when Anne asks why Mrs. Clay was with Mr. Elliot, Mrs. Clay gives a really weak excuse, and that pretty much ends the chapter. So what happens in the first half of chapter 11?
Okay, so in the first half of volume 2, chapter 11, Anne decides that she is going to delay telling Lady Russell about Mr. Elliot's true character one day longer. I hope we all remember what Mrs. Smith had to say about Mr. Elliot. So Anne has been, this has been revolving around in Anne's mind. She's thinking, I gotta tell Lady Russell, but now that the Musgroves are in town, she just doesn't quite have the time. So she's gonna put it off one day longer. And in this chapter, she goes over to the White Hart to visit everyone, and she finds that the room is just, the only people in the room are Mrs. Croft, Mrs. Musgrove, Captain Harville, and Captain Wentworth. Charles, Henrietta, and Mary are all out on the town, but they're going to come back soon. And Wentworth and Croft are there. They're writing a letter together. They're working on something. And while Wentworth is writing this letter, Anne gets into a conversation with Harville, and she finds out that they've been commissioned, specifically Harville, to get this portrait of Bennick set for Louisa, even though Bennick originally had the portrait done with Fanny Harville in mind, but oh well. And this conversation between Anne and Harville eventually becomes about who loves longer, men or women, and I won't get into it all now, but Wentworth finishes his letter. Him and Harville leave, then a minute later, Wentworth comes back, and he's like, oh, I forgot my gloves, and he hastily shoves a letter at Anne, and I won't go into what the letter says. We'll leave that for when we get to it. Okay, do you want to start reading, Grace?
Sure. Chapter 11. One day only had passed since Anne's conversation with Mrs. Smith, but a keener interest had succeeded, and she was now so little touched by Mr. Elliot's conduct, except by its effects in one quarter, that it became a matter of course the next morning still to defer her explanatory visit in Rivers Street.
Okay, little touched meaning, like, Mr. Elliot's conduct really doesn't matter to Anne anymore right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except by its effects in one quarter, and what's that mean?
Except by how it affects one thing in her life specifically.
Which is what?
Which is her and Wentworth.
Yeah, like Wentworth thinking, oh, they're engaged, I better stay away. That's the only effect that Mr. Elliot has on Anne's life anymore. Mr. Elliot is also kind of just like fallen out of this narrative in a way. He was just there to create a little tension between Anne and Wentworth, but not very important now.
Okay, so she had promised to be with the Musgroves from breakfast to dinner. Her faith was plighted, and Mr. Elliot's character, like the Sultaness Scheherazade's head, must live another day. It's quite the reference.
Well, what is the reference?
So the Sultaness Scheherazade is from the Arabian Nights, or what is it, 1001
Nice.
Nights, where it's told from by this the Scheherazade, the Sultaness, basically. And I'm sure maybe people have heard of this before, where there's a king who marries and kills a new wife every single day out of like suspicion of infidelity or whatever. So this one wife, that Scheherazade, she formulates a plan where she will tell a story to the Sultan and not end it, and thereby convincing the Sultan to let her live one more day so that she can keep telling the story. And so she does that for like 1001 nights.
That's the framing device of this
Yeah.
whole book. I've never read A Thousand and One Nights myself, but I know it was very popular in Regency in Victorian England. It's referenced a whole bunch in a lot of different other books as well.
We're
Kind of,
also, oh,
yeah, go
sorry.
ahead.
Yeah, we were also saying like just another instance of like a real life reference in Persuasion, that which is something not very common in Jane Austen, I feel like.
Like a literary allusion that's not like characters discussing books. That's like a narrator saying this was like this other thing that happened in a book. That's a very common practice among Austen contemporaries. Something Austen doesn't do a whole lot. I feel like she does it in this book more than in
Yes.
anything else.
Yeah.
It's kind of a strange, like the literal like reason that she makes this reference is just like, oh. Because in the way that Scheherazade keeps putting off her beheading, I guess, is similar to how Anne keeps putting off telling Lady Russell the news. It's kind of a very charged allusion to throw in here, like this Bluebeard type figure.
Yeah, 'cause also, I mean, it's very interesting because I think like also the hero of the story of Arabian Nights is the wife who manages to like live long enough to trick her husband long enough into staying alive. But here it's been compared to Elliot's true character, which is like not a good thing. So it's like comparing like this like heroic endeavor to like, you know, something that like should happen sooner rather than later, like revealing his true character. So it's just an interesting, yeah, like you said, a really interesting way to frame it.
Yeah, if you have any ideas as to why Austen is, if there's any connection between this narrative and Persuasion that you can see, let us know.
Maybe it's also just kind of ironic, you know, like Mr. Elliot managed to live another day in a way, his reputation anyway.
Through no doing of his own.
Right.
It's just because like Anne is busy with other stuff.
Okay, Anne could not keep her appointment punctually, however. The weather was unfavorable, and she had grieved over the rain on her friend's account and felt it very much on her own before she was able to attempt the walk. So I guess it's just like rains a lot or something, and so because of that, she's late to visit the Musgroves.
Yeah, she had grieved over the rain on her friend's account. Like, who wants to go on vacation somewhere and it rains, right? That's always kind of bad. That's always kind of a bummer.
When she reached the White Hart, and made her way to the proper apartment, she found herself neither arriving quite in time nor the first to arrive. The party before her were Mrs. Musgrove talking to Mrs. Croft and Captain Harville to Captain Wentworth, and she immediately heard that Mary and Henrietta, too impatient to wait, had gone out the moment it had cleared, but would be back again soon, and that the strictest injunctions had been left with Mrs. Musgrove to keep Anne there till they returned. She had only to submit, sit down, be outwardly composed, and feel herself plunged at once in all the agitations which she had merely laid her account of tasting a little before the morning closed. There was no delay, no waste of time. She was deep in the happiness of such misery, or the misery of such happiness, instantly. So,
I think we have to finish this paragraph for the full context.
2 minutes after her entering the room, Captain Wentworth said,
He said, "We will write the letter we were talking of, Harville, now, if you will give me the materials." Okay. Yeah, these are kind of sticky sentences in a way. So here, let's break it down. Anne had only to submit, sit down, be outwardly composed, and feel herself plunged at once in all the agitations Okay, let's stop there. The agitations being what?
Being like near Wentworth and listening to him.
Like the romantic agitations of being close to Wentworth, right? Which she had merely laid her account of tasting a little before the morning closed. So, laid her account means, as far as we can figure, to like expect or to like plan. So, she had been expecting that she would feel some of the romantic, like a little bit of the romantic agitations that obviously Wentworth's been causing this whole book, right? Okay. And there was no delay or waste of time. So right away, here come the agitations, and was deep in the happiness of such misery, or the misery of such happiness instantly. Because, and this is why I wanted to finish the paragraph, because, and I think this is my reasoning as to why this is all talking about Wentworth, because these agitations are set off 2 minutes after Anne enters the room, she hears Wentworth say. And then this is what Wentworth says. "We will write the letter we were talking of, Harville. Now, if you will give me the materials." Okay. Materials were all at hand, on a separate table. He went to it, and nearly turning his back on them all, was engrossed by writing. Mrs. Musgrove was giving Mrs. Croft the history of her eldest daughter's engagement, and just in that inconvenient tone of voice, which was perfectly audible while it pretended to be a whisper. I feel like Mary does the same sort of audible whisper in the last chapter too. I
It's
guess.
probably a must or a Musgrove specialty.
Anne felt that she did not belong to the conversation. And yet, as Captain Harville seemed thoughtful and not disposed to talk, she could not avoid hearing many undesirable particulars, such as how Mr. Musgrove and my brother Hayter, and now this is in quotations, had how Mr. Musgrove and my brother Hayter had met again and again to talk it over, what my brother Hayter had said one day, and what Mr. Musgrove had proposed the next, and what had occurred to my sister Hayter, and what the young people had wished, and what I said at first I could never consent to, but was afterwards persuaded to think might do very well, and a great deal in the same style of open-hearted communication. So I feel like that's just kind of a gloss of everything that Mrs. Musgrove is saying, right? All stuff that we know.
Well,
Yeah.
what we didn't know was that there was initial hesitation of the Musgroves allowing allowing Henrietta to marry Hayter,
Hater.
Charles
Well,
Hayter.
what is this? What I said at first I could never consent to. What do you think she's referencing?
And what I said at first, what I said at first, I never could consent to. I think it's them getting married, right?
I think it's specifically them getting married so quickly. What the young people wished, what I said I could never consent to, but was afterwards persuaded to think might do very well. I'm basing that mostly on what happens later in this conversation, but okay. Yeah, I guess that's interesting. So the Musgroves did have some misgivings somewhere along the lines in this along the way in this engagement. Okay. The narration goes on to say, "Minutiae which, even with every advantage of taste and delicacy which good Mrs. Musgrove could give,
Could not give.
could not give, rather, sorry. Minutiae which, even with every advantage of taste and delicacy which good Mrs. Musgrove could not give, could be properly interesting only to the principals." So this is only interesting information to people who it actively involves, right? Mrs. Croft was attending with great good humor, and whenever she spoke at all, it was very sensibly, and hoped the gentlemen might each be too much self-occupied to hear.
Well, it's interesting here. We have this good Mrs. Musgrove, which is, if you see good blank, you know that it's like, it's in the same vein of like poor this, like poor Dick and poor and good Mrs. Musgrove. It's like she's good in that like she means well, even if the way that she's talking isn't exactly the most polished or like polite. You know, like Mrs. Croft doesn't care about all the nitty gritty details of how Mrs. Musgrove's daughter is now engaged and like. How she like you know the minutia yeah that the minutia is like it's all fine like what she's saying is fine even if the thing it's even if the way she's saying it is the way she's saying it is not great and the fact that she's saying it to Mrs. Croft is not great but it's like kind of harmless things to talk about.
Yeah, it's also she's saying it a little too loud.
Oh, that's
Like,
right, yeah.
Wentworth and Harville don't need to know all the inner, like, machinations of this engagement, right?
And then so it's the word good appears again. Mrs. Croft was attending with great good humor, which I think is
great good.
Great good humor, which means like, you know, she's kind of she herself knows like, well, you know, just saying like Mrs. Croft knows that this conversation is kind of silly, but she's gonna bear with it. Okay. Do you want to keep going?
Sure. "And so, ma'am, all these things considered," said Mrs. Musgrove in her powerful whisper, "though we could have wished it different, yet altogether we did not think it fair to stand out any longer." Yeah, well, this is why I'm saying I think it's all about how quickly they wanted to get married.
Mm-hmm.
"For Charles Hayter," this is also Mrs. Musgrove, "for Charles Hayter was quite wild about it, and Henrietta was pretty near as bad, and so we thought they had better marry at once and make the best of it, as many others have done before them. At any rate," said I, "it will be better than a long engagement."
"That is precisely what I was going to observe," cried Mrs. Croft. "I would rather have young people settle on a small income at once and have to struggle with a few difficulties together than be involved in a long engagement. I always think that no mutual..."
"Oh, dear Mrs. Croft," cried Mrs. Musgrove, so just cutting her off right there. "We know that one of the Crofts' favorite subjects is how short their engagement was."
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Mrs. Croft is not in favor of a long engagement. But, okay. So this just, Mrs. Musgrove gets carried away and cuts off Mrs. Croft short. She says, "Oh, dear Mrs. Croft," cried Mrs. Musgrove, unable to let her finish her speech, "there is nothing I so abominate for young people as a long engagement. It is what I always protested against for my children. It is all very well, I used to say, for young people to be engaged, if there is a certainty of their being able to marry in 6 months, or even in 12, but a long engagement..."
"Yes, dear ma'am," said Mrs. Croft, "or an uncertain engagement, an engagement which may be long. To begin without knowing that at such a time there will be the means of marrying, I hold to be very unsafe and unwise, and what, I think, all parents should prevent as far as they can." So that's a very specific and familiar situation, the hypothetical situation. To begin without knowing that at such a time there will be a means of marrying, which Mrs. Croft says is unsafe and unwise and something that parents should always try to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So that describes Anne's situation a long, long time ago.
Yeah, it doesn't... Well, they, of course, were never engaged, but maybe that was the reason they were never engaged in the first place, is because none of Anne's connections could see, like, when... You know, Wentworth hadn't even started to make his name in the world yet. Like, mm-hmm. there was no... They couldn't... What would have been the end date, you know, of their... If they had got engaged all those years ago, right?
Right. And so if they are speaking very loudly, this is probably something that, like, Wentworth can hear right now, about how it's kind of almost like a parent's responsibility to make sure that their daughters don't enter into unsafe and unwise engagements, where, like, they're not even sure if there will be a means of marrying.
Well, unfortunately, a broken engagement is just going to be a lot more, you know, at that time, create a lot more difficulties than it would now, you know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's going to be like, oh, it's almost like, you know, close to them being married in the first place. Like, mm-hmm. what happened? Right?
Right.
Okay, well, it says, Anne found an unexpected interest here. She felt its application to herself, felt it in a nervous thrill all over her, and at the same moment that her eyes instinctively glanced towards the distant table, Captain Wentworth's pen ceased to move. His head was raised, pausing, listening, and he turned round the next instant to give a look. One quick, conscious look at her.
Yeah, so there you go. It's kind of like, yeah, like someone speaks something very, very, speaks about something very, very familiar and like something that these two people have been through, and so they instinctively kind of look at each other.
Yeah, Anne looks at Wentworth. Wentworth stops writing and then takes a really quick look at Anne, right?
Yep.
Conscious look.
Mm-hmm.
The two ladies continue to talk, to re-urge the same admitted truths and enforce them with such examples of the ill effect of a contrary practice as had fallen within their observation. But Anne heard nothing distinctly. It was only a buzz of words in her ear. Her mind was in confusion.
I feel like this happens a lot with Anne, where, like, she hears something, and then, like, the rest of the world kind of just turns into, like,
mush. Yeah. It's very interesting. It's a I keep returning to like Henry James reading this book. I feel like that's a very Jamesian move, is to like be like thing in this present scene that sets off like a mental thought, and then like the scene kind of like fades away for the interior to come to the forefront.
Captain Harville, who had in truth been hearing none of it, now left his seat and moved to a window. And Anne, seeming to watch him, though it was from thorough absence of mind, became gradually sensible that he was inviting her to join him where he stood. He looked at her with a smile and a little motion of the head, which expressed, "Come to me, I have something to say." And the unaffected, easy kindness of manner, which denoted the feelings of an older acquaintance than he really was, strongly enforced the invitation. She roused herself and went to him. The window at which he stood was at the other end of the room from where the two ladies were sitting, and though nearer to Captain Wentworth's table, not very near. So just giving you a lay of the land. As she joined him, Captain Harville's countenance reassumed the serious, thoughtful expression which seemed its natural character.
I like this moment here. It's like Harville's like, come on over here, as if they were like old friends, basically, right?
Like Anne is once again kind of caught in this like the caught in this like anxiety attack maybe. And then like Harville kind of instantly breaks her out of that. Like gets her out of her head.
It's so I well, I mean, we can talk about more as we read this next these next few pages, but it's a very interesting, like, we have seen a one-on-one conversation with Anne and Harville, but it was pretty short, and Harville's always kind of like been a very peripheral character to this book, but I feel like him and Anne are like kindred souls in a way, almost kindred spirits, and I think Harville recognizes that in this moment. It's like maybe we're both like in the same headspace, you know?
Maybe he even like maybe he doesn't hear what the ladies are saying exactly, but he kind of is just like, the ladies are talking about nonsense. Let me talk to Anne about something more serious.
Well, I mean, we're gonna see what he's thinking about, and there's a reason why he's thinking about it. But okay. So he calls Anne over, and he becomes serious. He says, "Look here," said he, unfolding a parcel in his hand and displaying a small miniature painting. "Do you know who that is?"
Certainly, Captain Benwick.
"Yes, and you may guess who it is for. But," in a deep tone, that's in parentheses, "it was not done for her." Obviously, Louisa. You can guess who this miniature is for. It's for Benwick's fiancée, Louisa, but it was not done originally for Louisa. "Miss Elliot, do you remember our walking together at Lyme and grieving for him?" For Benwick. "I little thought then, but no matter." I little thought then what?
That he would get re-engaged.
Yeah, in the next like couple weeks, right?
Weeks, maybe like a month.
Okay.
Maybe like a couple months.
All right, he says, "I little thought then, but no matter. This was drawn at the Cape." Does your book say what cape this is talking about?
It says the Cape of Good Hope
Oh,
in
in Africa. Okay,
Africa,
all
where he'd
right.
probably been stationed
Yeah,
or,
yeah. "This was drawn at the Cape. He met with a clever young German artist at the Cape, and in compliance with the promise to my poor sister, sat to him and was bringing it home for her. And now I have the charge of getting it properly set for another. It was a commission to me." Ouch. This is such a kind of like morbid little errand for Benwick to run, have Carvel run for him.
Cause like let's not forget like Benwick's first engagement and the person that the painting originally was for
Right.
was Fanny Harville, Captain Harville's sister,
Yes.
who died very suddenly and very young.
Right.
And now Benwick's like, "Oh yeah, that painting that I was gonna give to your sister who was dead, not for very long. Can you please have it framed so that I can give it to my new
My new
fiance?"
fiance. It's almost bad enough that he's giving Louisa this painting that was done for someone else, but to have his dead fiance's brother be the one to frame it for him is actually a little bit of extra insult to injury.
Which is why it's kind of like Benwick is kind of someone that you're allowed to kind of laugh at despite how sad boy he is. Or and because of how sad boy he is. You know, he talks a big game about feeling feelings and reading Byron and all that, but then he gets instantly engaged to a bedridden woman who's like, you know, who he's known for I don't know, a few weeks.
Yeah, the like a young woman just falls into his lap, basically. The next young woman that is convenient for him to flirt with, he gets engaged to. And you know, well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but the reason, like, Bennick's character is important to the book and is interesting is, like, here is a counterpoint to Anne. Here is someone who claims to, you know, feel like to be eternally constant to this lost love and is not in the least bit, mm-hmm. versus Anne, whose love is right in front of her and flirting with other people and is able to stay, like, more committed than Bennick is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, to continue, Harville says, "Now I have the charge of getting this painting properly set for Louisa. Mm-hmm. It was a commission to me. But who else was there to employ? I hope I can allow for him." Meaning what?
I hope I can make allowances for him.
For Bennick.
Yeah.
I mean, who else was going to do it, right?
Yeah. And that way, like, I hope I can kind of just, like, cut him some slack.
I'm Bennick's, like, best friend, basically. It was easiest for him just to ask me to do it. "I'm not sorry, indeed, to make it over to another. He undertakes it," looking towards Captain Wentworth. "He is writing about it now." And with a quivering lip, he wound up the whole by adding, "Poor Fanny, she would not have forgotten him so soon." That's great.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting thing to think about here, because, like, you know, what Captain Harville must be feeling right now, you know, like, it's just, again, he is kind of in the periphery of the main plot, and yet Austin devotes, like, this time to allow him to, like, also become, like, a real character, you know, that with his own, like, with his own, you know, grief and his own, like, feeling, conflicting mm-hmm. feelings, all that stuff, like, that is all happening still, even, as they are, like, sort of orbiting the main plot.
I mean, Harville's one of the more tragic characters in this book. He's lame, he is, like, a lot poorer than a lot of the other characters, and he's got this, like, loss in his life, Fanny Harville, and he thought, there's gotta be a feeling of betrayal, I feel like, for Harville. Like, he thought him and Bennick were sharing the grief for this life, for Fanny, and then he, you know, realizes that Bennick was not feeling it anywhere close to how he, like, Bennick's grief was nowhere close to Harville's grief. Bennick is pretty, it's pretty easy for him to get over it, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he basically says as much. She would not have forgotten him so soon. Like, that's a pretty accusing way to frame it. Like, basically, like, yeah, Bennick has forgotten all about my dead sister, but she wouldn't have forgotten him so soon, you know? Anyway.
I mean, well, here, and I do want to say, I think here's another example of Wentworth being, like, a good friend. I think Wentworth understands that this errand is causing Harville some, like, pain, and that's why he is, like, undertaking it for him, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wentworth was also the one who broke the news to Bennick.
To Bennick, because,
again, Harville was so grief-struck that he couldn't break the news to Bennick. But, so Wentworth also, again, took up the mantle. And it turns out Bennick was okay the entire time.
Well, and then I think this is, you know, if we're looking for, like, practicalities, this phrase is why this kind of climactic conversation, this is the climax of the book, I know it doesn't feel like it, is this climactic conversation is between Anne and Harville, is because he says this very pertinent line, "She wouldn't have forgotten him so soon," mm-hmm. which of course is, you know, has a lot to do with Anne's own situation also, right?
Right. She goes, "No," replied Anne in a low, feeling voice. "That I can easily believe and relate to."
Harville says, "It was not in her nature. She doted on him."
And she goes, "It would not be the nature of any woman who truly loved." So, again, we have to remember this is all kind of semi within earshot of Wentworth.
Right.
And she's saying, a woman who's truly in love with someone wouldn't forget someone so easily.
Yeah. Captain Harville smiled, as much as to say, "Do you claim that for your sex?"
Oh, and she answered the question, smiling also, "Yes." Okay, so here we're going to kind of get into, like, a battle of the sexes moment about love. Mm-hmm. She goes, "Yes, we certainly do not forget you as soon as you forget us. It is perhaps our fate rather than our merit. We cannot help ourselves. We live at home, quiet, confined, and our feelings prey upon us. You are forced on exertion. You have always a profession, pursuits, business of some sort or other to take you back into the world immediately, and continual occupation and change soon weaken impressions.
So that's a very important paragraph. And I think to anyone who feels like maybe this conversation is very old-fashioned, this idea of, like, who loves more, men or women, it's important to remember that the context in which this book is being written, and this paragraph, like, discusses it, is, like, just the way that society was built was, like, one gender had way more, one sex had way more rights than the other did, right?
Yeah.
And so, Anne is arguing that this is intrinsic to, the nature of, like, how men and women love because of the experiences that they're allowed in the society, right?
Right. Which we know, which we've seen, and we've talked about multiple times in this podcast, like, also appeared in the book that, you know, women are kind of, they are, like, prey to their own thoughts. They have nothing else to do all day except think about their losses. Meanwhile, you know, men get to distract themselves and live more fulfilling lives. And of course, you know, that is kind of like what they say, you know, to get over a breakup, you have to distract yourself and do stuff and get out there into the world and not just sit at home and mope and, you know, mourn your losses. But that's all women can do because they're not allowed to go anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. All you gotta do is look at Anne and Wentworth. Wentworth went out and, like, made his name in the world, smarting from this heartache. And meanwhile, Anne had to, like, sit around with the woman who convinced her to give Wentworth up and not talk about it the whole time, and they won't even discuss it with each other, right?
Right. Also, yeah, kind of stuck in this house with, like, her father and sister who don't really care about her at all.
Mm-hmm. And so this is why. And it's definitely, this is a very important paragraph, I think also revealing, like, some of Austen's own thoughts and feelings about the society she lived in. But Anne is like, women love longer because we're not allowed the distractions that men have, right?
Yeah. Not to mention, also, Austen's own brothers were in the Navy.
Right.
So she probably saw firsthand how their wives were feeling at home, you know, like, not knowing if their husbands are dead or not, and just, like, not being able to go anywhere, do anything about it. So I think I have no evidence of this, but maybe there's evidence out there that, like, Austen probably, like, witness this firsthand.
Right. And that's why Mrs. Croft who is also in the room right now, is a very interesting character because she basically rejects that life for herself.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, she goes everywhere with her husband.
Yeah, she's not going to let her brain atrophy while her husband is out fighting wars.
Okay. Well, Harville responds to this. He says, granting your assertion that the world does all this so soon for men, which, however, I do not think I shall grant, it does not apply to Bennick. He has not been forced upon any exertion. The peace turned him on shore at the very moment, and he has been living with us in our little family circle ever since. So he's like, well, that's point, but counterpoint, Bennick has just been moping the last year, right?
It's not like Bennick was in a war very long after Fanny died, because it seemed like peacetime came, like, basically right after she had died. So he's also just been, like, kind of moping and not had much to do. Like, you know, like, oh, you know, like how Anne is saying women behave. But he's saying, like, yeah, well, Bennick's been lounging at home, eating my meals, eating my food. And...
Yeah, yeah. And he got over it pretty damn quick, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, what does Anne say to this?
She goes, true. Very true. I did not recollect. But what shall we say now, Captain Harville? If the change be not from outward circumstances, it must be from within. It must be nature, man's nature, which has done the business for Captain Bennick.
So first Anne is like, men are able to get over heartbreak quicker because they have jobs, right? They interact, they participate in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're allowed to. And Harville's like, well, what about Bennick? He's been moping around for a year and he got over his heartbreak. And Anne's like, well, I guess if it's not outward circumstances, then it's something intrinsic about men's nature that they don't love that long, right? As long as women.
Yeah.
Okay, but Harville says, no, no, it is not man's nature. I will not allow it to be more man's nature than woman's to be inconstant and forget those they do love or have loved. I believe the reverse. I believe in a true analogy between our bodily frames and our mental. And that, as our bodies are the strongest, as male bodies are the strongest, so are our feelings. Capable of bearing most rough usage and riding out the heaviest weather. What's he saying?
So Anne's previous point was, okay, well, men's nature is to just be and constant, basically. If it's not because of circumstance, then it's just something intrinsic about men that they can get over heartbreak easily. And then so Harville's counterpoint is actually, I think it's the opposite. I think the stronger your physical body is, the stronger your like feelings are. So because men's bodies are stronger, that must mean that their feelings are stronger. In direct contrast to what Anne just said. Well, it's a little different because we'll get to that later, because he's saying men's feelings are stronger, but Anne was talking earlier, what Anne was describing was constancy and ability to love longer.
Well, Anne has a great response to this. She says, okay, well, what does Anne say in
Yeah.
response?
She says, your feelings may be the strongest, replied Anne, but the same spirit of analogy will authorize me to assert that ours are the most tender. Man is more robust than woman, but he is not longer lived, which exactly explains my view of the nature of their attachments. Nay, it would be too hard upon you if it were otherwise. You, and just, I think she's talking about men in general here. I think we can say you have. Men have difficulties and privations and dangers enough to struggle with. You are always laboring and toiling, exposed to every risk and hardship, your home, country, friends all quitted, neither time nor health nor life to be called your own. It would be too hard indeed, and here in parentheses it says, with a faltering voice, if woman's feelings were to be added to all this.
Well, okay, so we go like two different places in this little speech from Anne. And of course, this like, battle of the sexes they're having here, there's really in Anne's mind, this is about one man and one woman, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
about herself and
Exactly.
Wentworth.
Okay, but I like this. So Harville's like, since men are stronger, that means our since men are stronger in body, that means our feelings are stronger, right?
Because everyone knows muscles equals
Yeah,
feelings.
exactly. And Anne's like, well, maybe your feelings are the strongest, but using your same analogy, I'm gonna say that even though men are stronger in body, women live longer, traditionally, right? Commonly. I guess even at that time, women had longer life
Well,
expectancies.
maybe because they're not getting blasted out of ships.
Blasted. Yeah, exactly. They're not fighting Napoleon. Okay. So she's like, yeah, maybe men love stronger, but women love longer, right? That's part one. And then part two is with everything you have to go through, with all like, this is kind of specifically talking about the Navy, I feel like, but with all dangerous professions, it's like you gotta focus on like doing your job and staying alive, right? It would be too hard. It would be hard indeed if women's feelings were added to all the risk and hardship, right? What is this? If woman's feelings, how do you read that? Like feelings for a woman or the feelings of a
I
woman?
think it means feelings of a woman. Like this is like he, well, she's describing men's feelings versus women's feelings. So men's feelings may be stronger, women's feelings are longer. So if men also had to deal with having to constantly think about heartbreak all the time, like there'd be they, it would be impossible. They couldn't do that and fight a war at the same time. So it's just like you already have so much going on. You have your war and you're always separated from your friends and you have no place to call your own because you're always fighting wars. So it's like you're already going through so much in the instant moment that you can't also carry the burden of heartbreak for that long a time,
I
I
feel like,
think.
yeah, she's kind of sugarcoating a little bit what she's saying to Harville, which is men are more inconstant. Like, men have less constancy than women, but maybe it's because they are, like, busy with other stuff. They've got to forget it, right? They got to just move on with their lives, or else they're going to be blasted to pieces.
Yeah, you can't be like thinking about like your lost love and look out for pirates at the
Yeah,
same time.
exactly. But of course, this harkens all the way back to these are the early chapters. This was one of the ways Anne justified giving up Wentworth, was that it's like she's just gonna be a burden on him. Like, she's like, this is for Wentworth's own good all those years back that I'm rejecting him, because like he's gotta go make his name in the Navy and he can't have like the burden of worrying about me at home, right?
Yeah, he can't think about having to like provide for his wife, his fiance. He can't have that on his mind when he's trying to, yeah, like you said, make a name for himself.
Okay. So Harville says, we shall never agree upon this question. Captain Harville was beginning to say, when a slight noise called their attention to Captain Wentworth's hitherto perfectly quiet division of the room. It was nothing more than that his pin had fallen down, but Anne was startled at finding him nearer than she supposed, and half inclined to suspect that the pin had only fallen because he had been occupied by them, striving to catch sounds which yet she did not think he could have caught. So,
okay.
Captain Wentworth's about to say something. Harville. I'm sorry. Harville's about to say something. Wentworth drops his pen, and Anne looks over, and she's like, oh, you know, I didn't realize Wentworth was that close. He probably has heard everything we said, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he was even trying to hear.
I love that. Like, yeah, Yeah, so I guess in the, prior to all this, Anne doesn't realize that Wentworth is listening or can listen to them. She's just speaking from the heart, which is, you know, apt because Anne is... these would be Anne's true feelings, right, regardless of whether or not Wentworth is listening in. So here we Anne and us find out that Wentworth has been eavesdropping. I mean, it's fair to say he was eavesdropping.
Oh, he most definitely was. We'll know for sure soon. But yeah, this is when Anne first realized, hey, is Wentworth listening to this the whole time?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like they're talking and she looks over and it's like, oh my God.
He's right there.
He's right there.
Have you finished your letter? Said Captain Harville.
Not quite. A few lines more. I shall have done in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll come back to this. This is an important part. Harville says, there is no hurry on my side. I am only ready whenever you are. I am in very good anchorage here. Smiling at Anne.
Ha ha. Naval pun.
Yeah, naval term. Well, I'm happy like being like staying here for the moment, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well supplied and one for nothing. No hurry for a signal at all.
So he's like he is like a ship. He's comparing himself to a ship.
Yeah, well, I'm at the dock right now and I'm enjoying a little bit of leisure. Okay. Well, Miss Elliot, lowering his voice, as I was saying, we shall never agree, I suppose, upon this point. No man and woman would, probably. But let me observe that all histories are against you, all stories, prose and verse. If I had such a memory as Bennick, I could bring you 50 quotations in a moment on my side of the argument, and I do not think I ever opened a book in my life which had not something to say upon women's inconstancy. Songs and proverbs all talk of women's fickleness, but perhaps you will say these were all written by men.
So he already anticipates what Anne could possibly say in argument,
which
is not a fair argument, because she goes, perhaps I shall. Yes, if you please. No reference to examples in books. Men have had every advantage of us in telling their own story. Education has been theirs in so much higher a degree. The pen has been in their hands. As Wentworth drops his pen. I will not allow books to prove anything.
Of course, this is Austin.
This is meta, yeah.
Coming through. Yeah. I love this. I think... I'm going to give Harville the benefit of the doubt and say that he was being a little, like, tongue-in-cheek, even, like, bringing up, every book talks about women's inconstancy. Like, yeah, it's true. But also, like, I think he knows, like, oh, this isn't, like, a defining... I'm not winning the argument with this point. I'm kind of joking a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, of course, you know, great line. Men have had every advantage of us in telling their own story.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Harville says, but how shall we prove anything?
If not with books. She goes, we never shall. We never can expect to prove anything upon such a point. It is a difference of opinion which does not admit of proof. We each begin probably with a little bias towards our own sex, and upon that bias build every circumstance in favor of it which has occurred within our own circle, aka confirmation bias, or anecdotal evidence, many of which circumstances... Perhaps, and in parentheses, perhaps those very cases which strike us the most, end parentheses, may be precisely such as cannot be brought forward without betraying a confidence, or in some respects, saying what should not be said. So, just like We can each, you know, there's, it's gonna be, there's, we're never gonna like let up and be like, oh, you're right, men or women love more than the other, because we all have our own confirmation biases and our own anecdotal evidence only to support our own claim. And the things that would probably support our claim are things that shouldn't be talked about in the first place.
AKA me and Wentworth, right? Evidence number one that I don't want to talk about. Ah, cried Captain Harville, in a tone of strong feeling. If I could but make you comprehend what a man suffers when he takes a last look at his wife and children, and watches the boat that he has sent them off in as long as it is in sight, and then turns away and says, God knows whether we ever meet again. And then, if I could convey to you the glow of his soul when he does see them again, when coming back after a 12 months' absence, perhaps, and obliged to put into another port, he calculates how soon it be possible to get them there, pretending to deceive himself and saying, they cannot be here till such a day, but all the while hoping for them 12 hours sooner, and seeing them arrive at last, as if heaven had given them wings, by many hours sooner still. If I could explain to you all this, and all that a man can bear and do, and glories to do for the sake of these treasures of his existence. I speak, you know, only of such men as have hearts, pressing his own with emotion. This is, I love this, this paragraph. It's like almost another book, or it's like a whole other story here for a second.
This is definitely Austen's like most passionate characters are all kind of in Persuasion. Passionate and like without a falseness, like really passionate.
Well, this is like a heart-wrenching scene. I love this. Like, I can't think of anything like more tragic than like watching like looking at your family and being like, God knows if I'll ever see them again, right?
No, it's a very touching, a very poignant, scene that he's probably had to witness hundreds of times.
And maybe this like intra this like sort of inner these inner machinations of the brain he talks about, like the man being trying to convince himself that he's not gonna that he's gonna see his family later than he thinks, right? So as not to disappoint himself. Maybe this is talking about what Anne was kind of getting onto about how men have to like in this time, how they in order to like survive, they've got to move on, right?
Yeah, he kind of is supporting her claim in this moment because they kind of have to shield themselves from getting too attached because they might never see them
These are
again.
like the rationalizations, kind of. They're in the like the same ballpark, I feel like. Also, just like yeah, I don't, I really can't think of an equivalent passage anywhere in Austen.
No, because it's also interesting. He's speaking about it as like a plea to make Anne understand, which is like, I don't know. It's very, I don't know. Yeah, it just, I like this dynamic between Harville and Anne because it's like they are kind of equals in this moment. They are having like, rational, well, except for here, actually, it's like they're having rational conversations about a relatively heated topic. But it's actually Harville, the first one who loses his cool.
I feel like this is where it's like this, they weren't really having an argument, but I feel like this is where the argument reveals itself as they're now just like swapping what it's like to be a man and a woman. They're just talking about their experiences
Yeah,
and
yeah.
what love is like from the two different sides. And he's almost like, this is the, he's almost saying like what Wentworth should be saying right now, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, Harville isn't speak. Well, he doesn't have children, so he's not speaking at.
He does have
Oh, he
children.
does have children. Okay. Wait, really? Because he.
Because the Harvilles are staying with Mrs. Musgrove.
Oh, right. Sorry, I got the Crofts and the Harvilles mixed up. But yes,
It's okay.
Harville. Yes. Okay. Oh, cried Anne eagerly. I hope I do justice to all that is felt by you and by those who resemble you. God forbid that I should undervalue the warm and faithful feelings of any of my fellow creatures. I should deserve utter contempt if I dare to suppose that true attachment and constancy were only known by women. No, I believe you capable of everything great and good in your married lives. I believe you equal to every important exertion and to every domestic forbearance, so long as, if I may be allowed the expression, so long as you have an object. I mean, while the woman you love lives and lives for you. All the privilege I claim for my own sex, it, and in parentheses it says, It is not a very enviable one. You need not covet it. Is that of loving longest when existence or when hope is gone. So yeah, she is again, once again, talking about her own experience here.
And I mean, this is...
Because she's... Yeah, well, yeah. Of course, the first thing she says is like to assuage his feelings and be like, oh, I hope you don't think I'm saying you don't know how to love. What I'm saying is that I think you are capable of love. Blah, blah, blah. Men's lives matter. So, she's claiming that women, not only do they love longer, but they love so long that they even are willing, that it is on kind of, women are almost like cursed with this trait of loving even when, to backtrack a little bit. She's also saying men will love if there is an object to love and loves them back.
Yes.
And goes a step further and says women will love even if there's no hope of being loved back, which is how she thinks she's willing, which is like how she has lived her whole life.
Right. And I mean, even just like thinking about the nature of her and Wentworth's like their rupture all those years ago, it's, it was never a question, Anne always loved Wentworth. If anything, like she thought like breaking up with him was partly out of love for Wentworth, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was for his own good.
Uh-huh. And then she was going to continue to love him. Despite the fact that, obviously, he would never come back to her, right? In her mind, anyway.
Yeah. She could not immediately have uttered another sentence. Her heart was too full, her breath too much oppressed.
"You are a good soul," cried Captain Harville, putting his hand on her arm quite affectionately. "There is no quarreling with you. And when I think of Bennick, my tongue is tied." I think he almost, like, concedes the point there.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Okay.
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. It's you were. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He concedes the point. Maybe because, to an extent, he also sees how much, how emotional Anne is getting. Because he's putting the hand on her arm affectionately, is I think maybe being like, okay, we're just gonna upset ourselves if we keep talking about this conversation.
They're definitely swapping experiences. Like, this passage from Harville about seeing the wife and family, that happened to him in his real life, obviously. Yeah, and now Anne is, like, getting right up to the threshold of, like, basically talking about Wentworth, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Their attention was called towards the others. Mrs. Croft was taking leave.
"Here, Frederick, you and I part company, I believe," said she. "I am going home, and you have an engagement with your friend. Tonight we may have the pleasure of all meeting again at your party." Turning to Anne. "We had your sister's card yesterday, and I understood Frederick had a card too, though I did not see it. You are disengaged, Frederick, are you not, as well as ourselves?"
And obviously, Frederick is Captain Wentworth.
Yep.
Captain Wentworth was folding up a letter in great haste, and either could not or would not answer fully. "Yes," said he, "very true, but here we separate... Here we separate, but Harville and I shall soon be after you, that is, Harville, if you are ready. I am in half a minute. I am ready in half a minute. I know you will not be sorry to be off. I shall be at your service in half a minute."
Okay, so Mrs. Croft is leaving. Mm-hmm. They're going to meet again at the non-dinner party, the card party. And Wentworth is folding up a letter very hastily, and he's like, "Yes, but we'll see you soon." And but like he and Harville are also planning on leaving.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm going to be done in half a minute, Harville. Just you wait.
Yeah.
Mrs. Croft left them, and Captain Wentworth, having sealed his letter with great rapidity, was indeed ready, and had even a hurried, agitated air, which showed impatience to be gone. Anne knew not how to understand it. She had the kindest "good morning, God bless you" from Captain Harville, but from him, not a word. Nor a look. He had passed out of the room without a look. Okay, so he is out, right?
Yeah. He booked it. Uh-huh. For some reason, he hastily folded up his letter and left the room.
Mm-hmm.
She had only time, however, to move closer to the table where he had been writing when footsteps were heard returning. The door opened. It was himself. He begged their pardon, but he had forgotten his gloves, and instantly crossing the room to the writing table and standing with his back towards Mrs. Musgrove, he drew out a letter from under the scattered paper placed it before Anne, with eyes of glowing entreaty fixed on her for a moment, and hastily collecting his gloves, was again out of the room, almost before Mrs. Musgrove was aware of his being in it. The work of an instant.
So, let's just break down the action here.
Okay.
Wentworth finishes the letter.
Yeah.
Him and Harville leave.
Yeah.
Minute later, he comes back. He's like, sorry, everyone, forgot my gloves. Oh, okay, so hold on a sec. He leaves with Harville.
Yeah.
And goes to the writing table where he had been.
Uh-huh.
Right? I guess, I kind of like this, it's very convenient for the narrative, what happens, but I guess it's just to, like, luxuriate in the space that he had just stood in, right? This is when Wentworth comes back. He says, sorry, everyone, forgot my gloves. Goes back to the desk, stands next to Anne, pulls this letter out of a bunch of paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pushes it toward her and gives her this look of entreaty.
Yes.
Okay, this all happens in a moment. And then he's gone again.
Okay. The revolution, which one instant had made in Anne, was almost beyond expression. The letter, with a direction hardly legible to Miss A. E., was evidently the one which he had been folding so hastily. While supposing to be writing only to Captain Benwick, he had also been addressing her. So that was why he said, oh, give me like 5 more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can safely say
yes.
that. When Harville and Anne were talking.
Uh-huh.
On the contents of that letter depended all which this world could do for her.
This world, yeah. The earthly realm.
Anything was possible. Anything might be defied rather than suspense. Mrs. Musgrove had little arrangements of her own at her own table. To their protection she must trust, and sinking into the chair which he had occupied, succeeding to the very spot where he had leaned and written, her eyes devoured the following words. Okay, I'm just gonna read it.
Okay.
If I can get through it without tearing up. I can listen no longer in silence. I must speak to you by such means as are within my reach. You pierce my soul. I am half agony, half hope. Tell me not that I am too late, that such precious feelings are gone forever. I offer myself to you again with a heart even more your own than when you almost broke it 8 years and a half ago. Dare not say that man forgets sooner than woman, that his love has an earlier death. I have loved none but you. Unjust I may have been, weak and resentful I have been, but never inconstant. You alone have brought me to Bath. For you alone I think and plan. Have you not seen this? Can you fail to have understood my wishes? I had not waited even these 10 days could I have read your feelings, as I think you must have penetrated mine. I can hardly write. I am every instant hearing something which overpowers me. You sink your voice, but I can distinguish the tones of that voice when they would be lost on others. Too good, too excellent creature. You do us justice indeed. You do believe that there is true attachment and constancy among men. Believe it to be most fervent, most undeviating in. And then he signs it off, FW.
Mm.
And then there's a extra, like, PS. I must go, uncertain of my fate, but I shall return hither or follow your party as soon as possible. A word, a look will be enough to decide whether I enter your father's house this evening or never.
So he has written this while listening to the conversation
yeah.
between Anne and Harville. Because he's actually actively responding to it
yeah,
in the letter.
Yeah, he's referencing her conversation
yeah.
with Harville.
Well, he says, at one point, he says, don't call men inconstant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, he says, you do us justice indeed, after Anne, like, concedes that men can be constant, right?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, because now, having read this letter and thinking about Anne's realization that Wentworth can, in fact, listen in on her conversation with Harville is very, you know, it has to be strategic in this setting. But Anne, in one turn, is signaling basically like, I have not stopped loving you, Wentworth, because with her talk about how women never stop loving even if there's no hope of love being returned,
mm-hmm.
And she also has to signal, like, I also believe that Wentworth, you still love me back. Yes, she has to say that all without saying anything to him in that moment. So it's like really, really brilliant of her and brilliant of Austin to be able to like make that happen, make this conversation happen without actually them having to talk to each other.
Right. Yeah, that was all for, I don't know. It was when, even when she didn't know she was talking to Wentworth directly, it's all about Wentworth, right?
Yeah, yeah. But then when she finds out that Wentworth can hear, she, yeah, it's maybe, like you said, like, well, Anne's just always so good natured that she would, you know, of course, she wouldn't say that, like, men are incapable of loving. But I think the fact that, you know, the fact that she said men are capable of love and loving strongly, I think was for Wentworth. I think it's her saying, like, I believe you still love me.
I believe you, yeah, some men can.
Some men, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Wentworth was almost doing, unknowingly doing Wentworth's bidding in a way.
You mean Harville?
Harville, I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. What a great letter.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Half agony, half hope. Well, you pierce my soul, I am half agony, half hope. I feel like that's one of the most famous lines from this book.
Mm-hmm. Tell me not that I'm too late, that such precious feelings are gone forever. Mm-hmm. I love this part. Oof, I'm trying not to fucking break my voice here. I offer myself to you again with a heart even more your own than when you almost broke it 8 years and a half ago.
Almost.
Almost.
Well, I still have heart enough to love you again, right?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's great. I mean, it's very interesting. It's like, you know, he says he has never loved anyone else but her, and,
well, okay, and,
yeah, I've not loved none but you. Unjust I may have been.
I may have been.
Weak and resentful I have been, but never inconstant.
Well, he never proposed to another woman, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Uh-huh. That's true. He never proposed to another woman. Yeah. And I think we, you know, in hindsight, maybe it's clear now that, like, all of the way he was behaving at Uppercross with Louisa and Henrietta, it was clearly, like, about Anne.
It was a reaction.
It was a reaction to Anne. So, yeah, like, you know, call it what you want. But, like, yeah, if he wants to call it love, then, like, fine, so be it. But, like, yeah, it is true that he has, like, never stopped thinking about her, and mm-hmm. all of his actions have been about her.
Yeah. Even when he didn't want them to be.
Yeah.
Even when he was, like, actively trying to break away from the memory of Anne.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, I guess it's just kind of like, you know, he might have appeared really cold and aloof, but that's because he was, like, trying really hard to appear cold and aloof.
Yeah. Well, he'd been weak and resentful, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Such a letter.
Oh, also, yeah. Yes, so we can confirm, yes, Anne is 100% the reason that he came to Bath.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
the only
yeah,
reason
yes.
he came.
He came for Anne.
Yes.
Yeah, well, where is it?
You alone
for have... you, yeah. I'm yeah. sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, you alone have brought me to Bath. For you alone, I think and plan. Mm-hmm. Have you not seen this? Can you fail to have understood my wishes?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know. Like, yeah, I mean, it's hard, you know. She can't just like assume that that's why you were here.
She knew what he was up to, but he had to make the first move in some way.
Yeah.
He said, I had not waited even these 10 days. Could I have read your feelings as I think you must have penetrated mine?
Mm.
And I think that's also an admission. Like Anne is this better of the two. She's better at reading Wentworth's feelings than Wentworth is at reading Anne's. Right.
Yeah. I love this part. I am every instant hearing something which overpowers me. Mm. You sing your voice, but I can distinguish the tones of that voice when they would be lost on others. Mm. Well, that's exactly how Anne felt about Wentworth. Was like, she was the only one who saw her and like and valued her and recognized her for like and like appreciated her.
Yeah. Well, this is just more. That's also more evidence that he is writing this letter as he listens to Anne mm-hmm. and Harville's conversation.
I mean, this also. I love this part earlier when. When he was leaning over, this part where he says, striving to catch sounds, which yet Anne did not think he could have caught. It's like, even just like, it's like not even sentence, they don't even have to hear sentences or words. It's just hearing each other's voice is enough to make them like, be like completely like, you know, completely like enraptured, you know.
I think the dropping of the pen is like, that's when maybe he starts writing this letter.
Yeah, I think so. That's a good, yeah. Because then Harville, well, this is also funny, because Harville was like, have you finished writing your letter, Wentworth? Do you think he, like, knows that Wentworth was eavesdropping, and he's saying kind of like, but, like, tongue in cheek, like, have you finished your letter? Or
No, I don't know if Harville,
is
how much
aware.
Harville knows. I don't think he knows about his history with Anne.
No one does really, except like Elizabeth and Sir Walter and
Well, I think, okay, so he says, have you finished your letter? And then when Wentworth says, not quite, I shall have done in 5 minutes, I think that's when he starts writing this
Yeah,
letter now.
I agree. I agree.
And then maybe he finishes, and that's, well, I'm just guessing now, but when Mrs. Croft leaves and Wentworth's folding up the letter, he's like, yeah, I'm gonna be gone soon, but I'll just be half a minute more. And I think that's probably when he writes this like quick PS, maybe.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, it's quite the mission here. It's quite a, like, something out of like a thrill. It's thrilling because it's like you're putting so much at risk, you know, first of all, just even addressing a letter to Anne and then pouring your feelings out like this. So it depended on so many things going right. I mean, he had to have planned to accidentally leave his gloves behind, come back to pick up the gloves, signal to Anne to read the letter, and then leave.
Well, it's convenient that Anne was at the desk already.
That's
It made
true.
his movements a lot easier than if she was like sitting in another part of the room.
Yeah. Like, imagine if she like sat back down with Mrs. Croft,
Yeah,
then what
then,
would have
well, then
happened?
she's not getting the letter, I guess.
Yeah.
But fortunately, it all works out. She gets the
Yay,
letter, yeah.
fortunately, yeah.
Okay. Such a letter was not to be soon recovered from. Half an hour's solitude and reflection might have tranquilized her, but the 10 minutes only, which now passed before she was interrupted, with all the restraints of her situation, could do nothing towards tranquility.
Because now she has to kind of pretend like nothing has happened, despite the fact that the biggest thing in her life has just happened.
Each moment, rather, brought fresh agitation. It was an overpowering happiness. And before she was beyond the first stage of full sensation, Charles, Mary, and Henrietta all came in.
And that's where we'll stop for now.
Yes.
So, yeah, life is just going on as normal. They're
Well,
gonna be like, "Oh, Anne, you look good. You look happy."
here we go. This is the that was truly the climax of this book, that Anne was having this conversation with Harville. Wentworth heard it and is like, that's all I need, you know. He was waiting for that. He's been hanging around Bath waiting for that signal that Anne still loved him, right? And he
Yeah.
got that from the conversation. Because she wouldn't be saying these things if she was about to get married to Mr. Elliot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she would not be saying like, "I women only love
One
one
person,
person forever,"
right?
even when there's no hope. Yeah, it's very pointed. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah.
And also, Mr. Elliot, hey, there's another example of a man who's gotten over his dead wife rather quickly,
That's
right?
right, yeah.
Even though they probably never loved each other.
Well, here the irony is, and this was in a note in my book, the irony here is that Wentworth is actually doing something that would support Captain Harville, or sorry, yeah, Captain Harville's claim that men do love for a long time, or men are capable of loving for a long time.
Well, I think. And I think this is why this, you know, this sort of battle of the sexes here is not so like old-fashioned, because I think the point Austen ultimately lands on is like there's not really a clear-cut answer, right? It's not always like the case that women always love more than men, you know. Sometimes men can just be as constant, right?
Yeah.
And here's Wentworth to prove it. It's just that Anne had never, she hadn't had any example in her life of the fact that a man's love lasts a long time, right?
Right. Yeah, no, we Yeah, Wentworth is actually the exceptional man here because, unlike Eliot and Bennick, he has steadfastly loved only one person and for and ardently for like his whole life.
I guess to do him credit, he never like he never proposed to Louisa, right? He never like fully threw himself into any sort of courtship that we
Yeah.
see.
Well, I don't think he was planning on ever proposing to her. And we'll
No.
yeah, like we'll get in the second half of the chapter, we'll see where his mind was at in regards to the whole like Louisa flirtation. That again, maybe depending on how you want to read it, maybe cuts him some slack as well.
I think a real turning point in that is that when it was Henrietta and Louisa both that he was flirting with, then it's just like fun and games. It's not very proprietous at all, but I think in Wentworth's mind, it's like, we're all having fun here. And then when
we're all having fun.
When Henrietta gets engaged, all of a sudden it becomes a lot more serious, right?
Right, yeah. When it's just one man and one woman. Yeah, well, so that was the first part of chapter 11. Got anything else?
I guess we should just leave it off there. We still have another half of this chapter to go. A lot of explanations and things to be cleared up. So yeah, we'll talk about that more in the next episode.
Right, and you can listen to that episode right now. You can listen to that episode right now if you subscribe to us at our Patreon. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, that'll be up next week. Yep. But I feel like we all should be very happy. We've reached what. We've been waiting for this for eight and a half long years.
Yes, and years and a half. We've been waiting. This is finally happening. Or will it? Or will it? We still have to... there's the coda that's like, Anne needs to give him a signal that all's clear. That,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not over the hill yet. Here are Charles and marrying Henrietta to delay us a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so until that next episode, I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace.
Bye.